Just a little background on Ken Johnson. Ken's lived in Central Australia since 1978. He's worked extensively with Walpiri people to bring Marla and Bilby back from the brink of extinction. And he was also part of the team that was involved in the creation of the Desert Park. So we'll delve into that, all of those things, a little during this time with Ken. First question, Ken. Where did you spend your childhood, and what were the most important lessons you learned in those days?
Well, I took my first breath in the Tongala Bush Nursing Hospital in 1948. Tongala Bush Nursing Hospital no longer exists, and Tongala is a small town in northern Victoria, locally known as Tonny. And it's there that I grew up with my family on a dairy farm.
Famous for its condensed milk, I think.
But you talked about important lessons and things too, I guess.
Yes.
And I think part of that was about... I had two older sisters that were 6 and 4 years older than me, so... And I lived... I grew up in the days when things were miles and pounds, shillings and pence. So I lived 4 miles out of Tonny. And most of my travelling around was, of course, by bicycle in those days. And because I was pretty much on my own, I kind of had to make my own entertainment and travel around in that way too. So I think the 160-odd acre dairy farm with 120 milking cows on it, Jerseys, and I had my mother was formerly a primary school teacher, and in those days, of course, as soon as you got married, you had to resign. I think she had two major lessons, I think. And that was, you got to do what makes you happy, and that's not sort of taking happy pills or stuff like that. I took from that if things are making you unhappy, invent your own future. Move to some place where you are happy. So take charge of your life, I guess, is really the bottom line of what she was saying. And the other lesson from my childhood, well, I guess, was one of hers, which was make sure you do whatever you say you're going to do, because then people can trust you and... feel confidence in you and I guess generate a bit of respect for the way you go about it. But I suppose the early lessons were look after yourself, make your own entertainment and make sure that you take charge of yourself.
Excuse me, have you got a microphone?
We
very
do.
Hard to hear.
That's actually the next question.
Speak up.
It's actually written on the piece of paper to find out. That one,
okay. Is that okay? Okay.
And I'll just speak louder. If that's okay, then I'll keep my eye on you. Okay. Ken, do you remember what the catalyst was that caused you to fall in love with nature?
That was a bit of a process, I guess. Being a farm boy in those early days, the attitude to wildlife was a bit like it was for every other farm boy, which was... you exploit it, actually. I spent a lot of time pulling wildlife out of the rivers and channels and things. Did a lot of fishing in those days. Again, you sort of bicycled yourself around to wherever you're going. There's lots of... And I didn't regard redfin, the English perch at the time. They were kind of very good eating fish and didn't regard them as feral or anything like that. And it wasn't until later that I understood that they were devastating the local fish population. And I did a lot of shooting and trapping too, I have to confess. In those days, Bridget Bardot had not had her impact on the fur industry. And so there was a fur trade, and I spent a lot of my childhood trapping water rats, it's a Hydromys species, and brush-tailed possums of all things, using rabbit traps, which are a bit of a no-no now too. I remember I used to ride my bicycle to school. This is when I went to the high school, or not high school, but Situka Tech actually, and I'd clear the traps on the way to school at the drainage channels and channels on the way, because water rats were considered a pest in those days, and hang whatever I managed to catch in a wheat bag beside my bicycle, hang there all day, and then I'd come home and reset the traps on the way home, and then get about skinning what I'd caught when I got home and pegging it out. And the similar thing with possums, which funded my first rifle, actually. It's the Winchester 5-shot repeating 22 rimfire rifle. But I did a lot of fishing with my dad. We travelled up into the Darling River area up around Wilcannia, and also the Edwards at Deniliquin. And again, it was a fair bit of shooting at that stage. And it was during that process that I guess I began to think I could understand that there was a lot of beauty in nature around me, and shooting it wasn't a very beautiful part of it. So I think there was no sort of moment when I said, aha. It was a process over this childhood period.
Okay. Where did you go to uni, and what did you actually study, Ken?
Well, I guess a step before that, because growing up as I did in a rural community in a dairy farm area, it was always considered that, because the family had been on the dairy farm for about 100 years, actually. My father, my grandfather, my great-grandfather, and so it was always expected that that was my fate, to come back and be a dairy farmer too. And part of that was going to Echuca Tech. And then I went to Dookie Agricultural College on the other side of Shepparton, the eastern side of Shepparton, and did a Dookie Diploma in Agriculture. But I guess at the end of that I thought, it was a bit of this, you got to do what makes you happy. And part of that was thinking that, well, I wouldn't mind just pursuing an education for a bit longer and to see what that turned into. And I tried to get into, well, I matriculated when I was at Dookie College, and I did that by taking matric English kind of externally. I read the novels and had some practice doing praises and stuff like that, and God knows how, but I managed to pass matric English, which gave me matriculation and university entry. And I tried to get into agricultural science at Melbourne Uni, but they wouldn't have me at that stage. And again, I must confess that I taught for 1 month at Echuca Technical School as a 19-year-old, poor kids. But then I was admitted into the foundation year of La Trobe University. I did first year science there. It was the hardest year I've ever put in, which is another story. Trying to do pure maths and stuff like that I'd never seen. I'd never seen a differential equation before. And I got through that, and Melbourne University still wouldn't take me, so I went up to New England University, which was a very good move because it's where I met my beautiful wife. So you asked me what I did, though.
I did.
So at New England University, I enrolled in rural science, did a Bachelor of Rural Science, which is a different kind of agricultural degree in those days too. And it had a significant effect on me, as most degrees do, I suppose. And it was a set course, so that the 4 years, there was no choice in what subjects one might take. And I remember particularly during my third year, we had 1 hour off in the week. And I can remember vividly coming back. I stayed in college during those years, and coming back, and the bloke who lived across, a good mate of mine, lived across the corridor from me, who was doing arts. And this was about midday when I got back, and he was just getting up. And I thought, what have you done, son? But the rural science degree was interesting in that it was wrapped up in the final year by the professor of the faculty, Bill McClymont. Bill had engineered this degree from its beginning, and he took a course in agricultural ecology, which was not done anywhere else in that time. And in fact, ecology was, you know, pretty much its infancy in those days too. But I'd done physiology and biochemistry and animal husbandry and you name it, the whole range of science subjects. And during those subjects, you know, you, in physiology, you learn that by applying an electrical current over a particular muscle that it twitches. And but Bill McClymont was able to draw all these things together so that you could see that when you looked at animal husbandry, and if your sheep got worms, then you gave them a good dose of thiobenzole. But Bill was able to let us understand that there was a bit of the broader base to this, in that the incidence of worms had a whole lot of implications in terms of what the density of stocking was, and the pasture conditions, and the age of the sheep, and the history. And he took a very broad ecological approach to agriculture, which was very innovative for the time, and made everyone in my class kind of went snap. Oh, that's what it's all about. And I think it was a very positive and useful degree. But again, I was that was a step not closer, really much, to the natural sciences. And I was working on a property just north of Griffith in New South Wales, and at that stage I was ploughing, going round and round and round in circles on a tractor in a paddock. Had quite a few Murray pines or Calitra species, and diving and dodging in and out that. And I was looking across the fence to the neighbouring property, which was a natural bushland, and it had natural grassland, and it had, you know, the usual trees and shrubs and stuff. And there was a small mob of grey kangaroos in this paddock. And as I went round looking at these kangaroos, I started to think to myself, I want to be on that side of the fence, not on this side. So it was a matter then of working out how to get on the other side of the fence. So I had a background in science, and I applied for a job with CSIRO Wildlife Research and wasn't successful there. And I applied for a job with Parks and Wildlife, actually, in New South Wales, and I wasn't successful there. So I thought, well, I better do something about my training, because really you don't have the background that might be necessary. And that's when I went on to do a PhD on paddy melons, red-necked paddy melons. At Dorrigo, which is on the New England escarpment east of New England, east of Armidale. And it was interesting, actually, when I graduated from there, my parents were sitting in the crowd, and as the usual thing, your PhD thesis topic is read out, and then the ecology of paddy melon, da-da-da-da-da, and the people sitting next to my... One of the blokes sitting next to my parents said, the only paddy melons I know are cucurbits. So I obviously had a fair bit of education to do in front of me.
Okay. So in 1978, you came to Central Australia. What was your first impression of the Red Centre?
Yeah, I came to Central Australia from Tasmania, actually, because I've been working down there for 3 years, studying possums and wallabies down there and methods of assessing their abundance. And when there was the fur trade in brush-tailed possums down there, they're taking between 100 and 300,000 of them a year. But coming to... I'd always wanted to get back to the dry country, because I'd grown up, although it was an irrigation place, it's a low rainfall, about 16, 17 inch rainfall, which is pretty close to the 10 or 12 that you have here. And this offered a remarkable opportunity to get back in there. It was Alice Springs was a much smaller town in those days. We'd just got through to self-government on the 1st of July 1978, so things were changing. The whole environment of the centre in terms of the bureaucracies were hugely different, in that they more or less had too much money. The government really was battling to find the ways to spend it all. So it was a good time to start. working here in what was then the Territory Parks and Wildlife Commission, which was based out of the old Advocate, what the Advocate now occupies on Gap Road. But it was a fascinating little area. I remember I was interviewed by Tom Hare, who was the then director of the organisation, which had just converted from the Reserves Board to Territory Parks and Wildlife Commission. And I did a trip with Graham Ride in the day I had before I went back to Tassie, out to Ormiston Gorge, which was a dirt road all the way then. And it was just a remarkable bit of country. The first impressions, I suppose, were a large Aboriginal population, which I found fascinating, and obviously there were some opportunities there.
Thanks, Ken. Ken, tell us about your meeting and working with Mr. Jumpa Jimpa, and what was the most profound thing he taught you?
Getting to meet Darby out at Yundamur. When I arrived, I guess just taking a little step back, in Tassie I'd begun to think about fire because I'd seen one of the field areas I had where fire went through. I could see that there's some very curious differences. It wasn't actually just devastating the countryside. There were some very useful things that came up afterwards. It had a big impact on the fauna that was there. And when I arrived in Alice, my work was out at the Arizona Research Institute. We're on the western end of that block, working alongside Dave Torlak and Colin Stanton, who were in soil conservation and land conservation. And the botany unit was down the other end. That's where the Northern Territory Herbarium was housed in those days, run by John McConnick. And there was another bloke down there, Peter Kenneth Latz, whom I got to know. And I remember having a conversation with Latzo down at the tea room just before he went off to dive into the piranha pool in New England, in National University, where he wrote, where he did the groundwork for Bushfires and Bush Tucker. But having a good conversation with Peter about fire, and so it was sort of kindred spirits in many ways, and I got to think, well, this is going to be a pretty exciting time. But the first trip I did was with Peter and Tom Henschel, actually, who was a technician out at the Herbarium at that time. And so we were going up to join with CSIRO at Supaljack Station, which is on the northwestern edge of the Tanami Desert. And that station had just commenced operation, and CSIRO were interested in monitoring the changes to the environment that came about from the introduction of cattle onto the place. But on the way, Peter took me to the Mala colonies, which we now know as Lunkadajara, just on this side of the Granites gold mine, which wasn't a gold mine at that stage because there was nothing operating. And so he showed me what he and Bill Bolton had been doing and the basis for their watershed paper, really, on the impact of fire on the Mala, or the Rufous Hare Wallaby. And we went up to Supaljack Station. And on the way back, Peter, of course, was talking, as Peter does pretty well, and talking about his early days at Hermannsburg and how he met up with Chris Benz, and how Chris and her husband Carl were at Yundamu. So I badgered Latso all the way back to Yundamu, pretty much. I said, well, you should go in and call in and say good day. So, which he finally did. And so I got to meet Chris and Carl, and which formed the basis for me then getting back to them to come out to Yundamu to, at a later time, to begin talking with people about the fauna. And the first time I went out there, Jumpa Jimpa was the person I was introduced to. It was a bloke who knew heaps and had pretty good English too to be able to communicate it. So that was the first time I met with Darby, and I can remember going through the Reader's Digest Book of Birds with him, and he was pointing out, you know, the ducks and brown falcons and giving names, Kilkalanji for the brown falcon. And we got to the mallee fowl, and he said, oh yes, that one too. And I said, mallee fowl? Because that's, if you have a look at the 1977 Book of Australian Birds, mallee fowls are not recognised from this part of the world. Oh yes, he said, it's got a pink egg. So I thought, must be right. So it was a kind of seminal moment for me too, that there's a lot more than I had ever expected to learn here from people like Darby. And that's how I met him.
How did you feel seeing a mala in the wild for the first time?
Yes, well, mala was a curious thing actually, but the two populations, or one of them actually, was discovered by Alan Newsom back in the 1950s. And Alan had been out, he was studying dingoes at the time, and he just went out to this sandhill, this is again the Lunkatadara area, and he saw these curious tracks which he couldn't make head and a tail of. So he eventually got hold of an Aboriginal bloke, he said was called Murray, from further back towards Mount Doreen, and brought Mr. Murray out to Lunkatadara, and he identified these tracks as those of the mala. And I don't think Alan was entirely sure what a mala was, because Murray couldn't tell him in Western scientific terms. But he also said that there were tracks of the buckaroo there too, which is a golden bandicoot. So that was sort of the initial stages there. And then Dave Howe and others who worked with the wildlife group in the 60s had been making periodic visits, and Bill Bolton, who joined them as the biologist a little bit later, had studied them there. But the only thing one ever saw was a bit of a blur as these things bolted from out underneath the spinifex. And so they'd come back to town and say, oh yeah, well, we've been studying the mala. Well, what do they look like? Well, a blur. And we know what the tracks and the scats look like, but so you go out there to the mala colony and, oh yeah, you're going to study these mythical little animals again. What's really going on? But it was, I felt we had to address this scepticism somehow. So I remember being out there, I was out there with Rick Ward, who was a Canadian bloke who was volunteering at the time. And Rick stayed back in camp, and I had taken out a motorbike battery and a spotlight and my Pentax camera with a 200mm lens and a flashlight on the top of it. And I thought, well, I'll see if I can tippy-toe and get close to take at least a photograph of these things. So I was spotlighting along the old stock route, as it was, and spotted this mala about maybe 200-odd metres away. So carefully trying to get out without rattling anything, and hooked up the spotlight, and it was still there. So tippy-toed my way, sort of taking photographs where the mala was about as big as a flea in the middle of the frame. But it was a photograph of a mala, nonetheless. And I got closer and closer and closer and taking more photos. And in the end, I had to back off because I couldn't get the thing in focus. But that was another lesson too, because it told me that you could get close to these, and very close to these animals, if you went the right way. So I went with Rick then the following day up to Rabbit Flat, and went called in to see Bruce Farrens and Jackie, and out at their rubbish dump I got some fencing wire and some old tossed away wire netting, and I made this hoop that was about, you know, with a few strands of wire around, and twitched it together, and that was about a metre and a half or so wide, and made a hoop of netting over the top of that, and together with Rick we again sort of tippy-toed through the system and got hold of mala in the spotlight. And it was that matter then of taking a flying leap with this hoop stretched out in front and trying to land it over the top of the mala. and then not getting bitten too much on trying to get it out from underneath. And it was successful because we were able to bring five mala back to Alice Springs and establish them at the Arizona Research Institute. And that's the basis of the populations now in the Desert Park and a lot of other places. So it was a pretty exciting time.
It was. Your old friend H.H. Finlayson was born in 1895 and died in 1991. He undertook a number of expeditions into our central deserts during the 30s and 50s in pursuit of his passion to collect and understand native mammals. Can you tell us a bit more about Finlayson's work and what was he like? So let's start with his work, Ken.
His work. Herbert Hedley Finlayson, he was actually a biochemist, trained as a biochemist. But he had a couple of accidents in his early years, in his teens actually. And I'd only begun to understand more recently that he had these two accidents, one in 1910 when he was 15, playing around with explosives, and he blew the tops of three fingers off and one thumb of his left hand. And then 3 years later he did the same thing again and lost the whole hand and this first knuckle of his right thumb and one eye. But that changed the course of his life, no doubt. He continued work at the university, but I think he had some mentors at the university. One was Professor Rennie, and another was Professor Wood Jones. And Wood Jones, I think, was a fellow who encouraged him to develop an interest in mammalogy. And he did some quite stunning work. I think it was just extraordinary. He's the sort of bloke who wrote 60 scientific papers. Three of those papers were in Nature, which is not a bad achievement. And he wrote on anything from fossils to birds to insects, but mostly on mammals. And it's the sort of stuff that everyone who's interested in Central Australia, really, but particularly mammalogy, should read. And the one that you must read is this one, The Red Centre. That's a book that everyone who's going to spend more than 5 minutes in Central Australia should read. Because it's written in 1935, but it's an extraordinary book and extraordinarily prescient, I think, of what was to come. He was observing it then. Finn was remarkable in that he had a foot on either side of the major bout of extinctions that occurred between the early 30s and the early 50s. When Finn went through South Australia, northern South Australia, he was observing areas of mulga that had been more or less rotary hoed by bilbies. He was able to collect a nice series of specimens of the mala. He collected the only recent specimens. There were three, I think, collected originally of the desert rat kangaroo, Calloprimnus, which actually means beautiful rump. You should store that one away. You might need that sometime. Calloprimnus. But he collected recorded the only scientific information on this species. He recorded the only scientific information on the lesser bilby, sort of incidental to his trip to collect the Calloprimnus. There's a whole range of stuff I could go on and on about him. But and an extraordinarily tenacious man, and I think a good model for any scientist. If you look at any of Finn's stuff, he's meticulous in recording whatever he did. Even his photographs. I mean, that's easy today because your digital camera records everything that happens, even where you are, if you want it. But Finn recorded shutter speed, the f-stop, whether he's in sun or out of sun, how far away he was, and particularly he recorded the names of people that he photographed. And particularly important amongst that was he recorded the names of Aboriginal people that he photographed, which is not necessarily a common thing in those days. And some of that the land councils used. Vince Forrester, I was able to give Vince a photograph of his mum in her early years and his grandmother and etc. Because of Finlayson, he had about 5,000 odd images that he recorded. But he left a remarkable scientific legacy that, and I should read you just one little patch from this book. This is written in 19. This is published, so it's written a bit earlier. It comes from a series of newspaper article he wrote for the Adelaide Register, and he's talking about the introduction of stock and Western land use in Central Australia, and he says, "The results of all this are hailed by the statistician and the economist as progress and a net increase in the wealth of the country. But if the devastation which is worked to the flora and fauna could be assessed in terms of the value which future generations will put upon them, it might be found that our wool clips and our beef and timber trades have been dearly bought." And he goes on a little bit later to talk about he's not lining up the pastoral industry here necessarily. He's saying that it's implicated, but he says, "But it must always be remembered that even in those tracts where no stock have been depastured, those enterprising pests, the rabbits, the foxes and feral cats, have in many cases gone on before and worked untold damage and change." 1935. I recommend this book to you.
So what was he like?
Deaf. Well, nearly deaf. And when I first got to know him through John Callaby, actually. John, I talked yarning to John at a Mammal Society meeting. He said, "Oh," and I was asking about Finn because I knew he knew him. And he said, "Well, he lives at 305 Ward Street, but if you're going to go and visit him, you must write to him first." Because Finn was born in 1895, and Queen Victoria was still on the throne then, and for a little while after that too. He had a very Victorian attitudes, and I think mainly because he was deaf and he needed to have some warning that a person was coming so he could hear the front door knocker, which also had a little notice on it, "Knock loudly." I wrote to him and sent him some photographs because I knew that he'd done a lot of photography himself. And I got a very welcoming letter because Finn had had a bit of an altercation with the South Australian Museum where he'd worked for 35 years, and he was kind of on a bit of the outer, which is another story in itself. So I used to visit him on every time I went to Adelaide, really, over a little over 10 years. And it wasn't until about halfway through that he started to wear a hearing aid, and he mostly had batteries in it. So it was really sort of about face-to-face was the conversation, and it was a very loud one, so it was probably as testing for him as it was for me. But he was just an extraordinary character, and I hope to be able to tell his story sometime.
Yeah, I'd like to hear that one. Just moving into a slightly different area here, what do you love most about Central Australia, Ken?
Probably what you and everybody else love about it, I suppose. And you know, the people and the landscapes, the plants and the animals. It's probably one of the least affected regions of the continent in terms of... The sort of ecological processes are still sort of ticking over to a large degree. I mean, I grew up in irrigated dairy country where there's hardly anything of that left, yep, apart from grey box trees. Yeah. The Aboriginal and the Western interface, I think, is critical to me. I can remember being back in Gunnedah where my wife Marg grew up, and walking down the street and there was a bit of yakkaing just down the street, which is uncommon in those areas, and it's really just felt like home. It was a really positive, happy feeling. And the land's full of eccentrics. I've already talked about one of those that I met, P.K. Latz. And it's a great environment for those sorts of eccentrics, and it's a small enough environment or community where you get to know them too and be able to interact with them. So, and it's a great place for kids to grow up, I think. My three children have grown up here, and it's been a very strong basis for their lives, I think, as I can see.
Ken, one of the highlights of your career as the regional director for Parks and Wildlife was the creation of the Alice Springs Desert Park. What were some of the highlights and of planning and opening of the park that, as you saw that vision become a reality?
How long have we got?
not that long.
It was one of those things that happens in your life that you never, ever expect to. I never, ever thought to be doing anything like being involved in the creation of this. And so it really started with a letter from the then Chief Minister Marshall Perrin, following a study of tourism in Central Australia that showed that the visitors here didn't get to see the plants and animals too much. And he wrote to the then Mayor, Leslie Oldfield, saying, we want to establish an annex to the Darwin Botanic Gardens, and we want to have something that's sort of kind of a wildlife display, sort of not the same as the Territory Wildlife Park, but something so that people can see a few animals. So I was just then appointed as the Regional Director of the Conservation Commission, Regional yep. Director South, and they said, fix it up. which I guess is something to think about too, because I doubt whether that kind of approach would be used these days. And I think it was an indication of the great freedoms that were enjoyed by everyone living here at that time. You had a chance to do things without huge constraints. The positive thing was being able to work, and the whole thing was teamwork, which I think is very enjoyable, and it's hugely productive, I think, if you can work in a relatively ego-free space, which you have to really to work in a team, work together to get things done. It seemed to me at the time that Alice Springs was never going to compete with Melbourne Zoo or Taronga or Adelaide Zoo or any of those sorts of places who had much more money than what we would ever have. So we would never compete if we're going to have a viable tourism facility here. So it was a matter of doing something different and perhaps something that they couldn't do. And you're looking through that window now at it, I think. The great things were, firstly, having the opportunity to work with a couple, I think, unsung heroes of that the planning stage from the Conservation Commission side, and that was Alan Ginns, who was a planner here at that time, and Peter Hay, who was a landscape architect. And I think they were critical to what you see outside there now. Alan Ginns had done a lot of the groundwork in choosing the site, and it's I think a magnificent site. And we're very fortunate at the time that the land was seen as not being useful for future housing because rocks might fall down off that hill onto the houses below. It was available. So Alan in particular looked at anything from Simpson's Gap through to the other side of town, and this was settled on as a viable and workable place. And it was a matter then of getting the concept plan through, and at that stage, until the concept plan came together, I think neither we nor government knew what we were heading for. I'm sure they had their ideas, but we certainly think a bit broader than that. And I guess from my background, trying to get something different was something representative of the region that we're in, and being able to present the plants and animals in a relatively in context with their environment, in a kind of ecological basis. And the other part of it, because I'd done quite a fair bit of work with Aboriginal people, was being able to present the Aboriginal context of the environment, not getting anywhere near the mythologies and those sorts of things, but being able to interpret how the landscape was used and managed, and more or less what those processes were. Some important steps along the way. I can remember our first meeting with the custodians, which was out probably in the bottom of the clay pan over in the Desert Rivers habitat. And Charlie Perkins was there, and a range of other people, and trying to explain what were rudimentary concepts in our own minds about what was going to be here, apart from pull all these concepts together and present them as in their context. And we went through quite a fair process there, because the first steps with the native title was then not in existence, so that was a different situation. The custodians at the time had to come to grips with what this bunch of people from the Conservation Commission were on about, and we had some restrictions on the up where we could, as far as we could go up the range, because that's of course a sacred site. And part of the process was working with Peter Blackwood in the Aboriginal Areas Protection Authority, suggesting to us that we take a group of people up to the Territory Wildlife Park so that they can have a look at what's involved in this stuff. Being able to have a look down manholes and see that, yes, you've got to get pipes and water and electricity and things in here, but so you've got to dig a big trench to make it happen, but you can rehabilitate it pretty well. And that was working together with the custodians, I think, produced with us a pretty satisfying, from everyone's point of view, result. It was, I think, I'm pleased with the way the Aboriginal training program kicked off. So we started training 4 young Aboriginal people as guides to begin with. Carolyn Braden, Garth Forrester, and Melissa Little, and another bloke whom I can't remember at the moment. But they all 4 of them completed their training, and 3 of them started work with us, and I think it's gone on from there. So that was another part of the difference of the Desert Wildlife Park, or the Alice Springs Desert Wildlife Park and Botanic Gardens it was then. We tried to make it pretty broad so we wouldn't get locked in, but it became known as the Desert Wildlife Park, and it's only really begun to become the Desert Park of more recent times, I think.
Yep.
So that was important. I think the master plan that came together and formed a good blueprint for what is in place now, and it still seems to be working, so I'm pleased that the master plan came together.
Okay, Ken, what do you think is important for non-Aboriginal people to understand about Aboriginal people in order for us to move closer towards reconciliation?
If you're moving towards reconciliation to me means movement from 2 directions, converging.
Yep.
So it's not a matter of one side getting to know the other better, it's a matter of both sides getting to know each other better. And reconciliation can only happen, I think, with understanding, because with understanding you can begin to see the perspectives of the other side, if you want to put it that way, and respect. So learning about each other I think is the only way that reconciliation can really happen. It's a two-way process. And there's been some extraordinary movement, I think, within the Aboriginal population in terms of the cultural position. Huge change. I mean, Darby was born out bush. He learned English. I think the thing that really stuck in my mind was being down in Melbourne, and I think it was Australian Geographic. I was looking through and there was a CD in the window with something biological on it, and here was Darby's photograph on this CD, and I thought, bloke, he always said, early days, we lived out bush, no tea, no sugar, no trouse, nothing. And here he is on this cover of a CD, and I thought, what a journey that must have been. Huge, enormous. So understanding on both sides is how it must be, and respect.
Okay, what are you most proud of in your professional life so far? Given that you're still so involved in so many things.
Oh, oh gee, most proud of. I'm proud of forming, I hope, or from my perspective anyway, a workable relationship and understanding with the Walpri people over many years, and that still goes on. So I was able to make that transition from Western science to, and I think they accommodated both sides as well, because they certainly gathered an understanding of what Western science meant as I was trying to grapple with their perspectives. Of course, we're sitting in one of the things I'm very proud of. The Desert Park, I think, has been a great journey, and it's a fantastic facility. You only have to look at the comments by visitors that come here and the people that work here too. I'm proud to have been involved with the Territory Parks and Wildlife Commission, the Conservation Commission and the Parks and Wildlife Commission after that, and the Desert Desert Knowledge Australia initiative as well, that's up and going, and I think making some great steps. 30 years ago when I was heading out, it was the same situation in many ways. There was a whole lot of stuff which Finlayson saw that I wasn't seeing and will never see out there. I think the lesson in that is that you need to be looking at what you have now and making sure that someone in 30 years' time is not going to say the same thing. I think value what you have. Don't feel angry about it. Think about what you can do about it and making sure that it is sustained.
I think on that rather poignant remark, we might draw it to a close. I think we can carry that one away with us. Thanks very much for coming along and joining us. Feel free to get another coffee or tea on your way out, and perhaps if you put your hands together for Ken, thank you. Thanks, Ken. Thanks for coming along.